Oh, very interesting.
Right? And so, I'm pretty sure what he's extrapolating on is that time only, quote-unquote, passes because creation resides within God, who is consciously aware.
Oh, wow. Okay, so, that hurts the brain.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of... Actually, you know what, Murray? Right off the bat, we just have to say, we really don't know what we're talking about, really.
Start right there.
You know, we just don't know what we're talking about. We're like, it's funny. You know, before I can even get out the voices of the desert thing...
We need a quote from Dumb and Dumber right here.
Yeah, we need a quote from Dumb and Dumber or something, because it's like we're talking about these heady theological things, and really, Marie and I just have to let you, the listener, know we really don't know what we're talking about.
We might have touched it, you know, enough to know the reality, but we, you know, it's kind of like I got to look through a keyhole a couple of times.
And that's a good one. Yes, that's right. We got to look through a keyhole. So this is the asterisk before we've even done the introduction. Everybody.
Yeah, let's do it that right. way. Like, because it'll be so different. People will go, "Wow, that's different." It'll catch them.
This is the recording right now. So Murray thinks that we're not actually.
He's sneaky.
It's very sneaky. That's
did
right.
Did I see something with Dumb and Dumber? I think
Yes. That is. Well, you know, we'll be Dumb and Dumber. There was a third one.
So everybody, hey, thanks for joining us.
Welcome to Voices from the Desert, the podcast of two guys who know nothing. That's right. Actually, there's this
in comparison to the vastness of the Godhead.
Exactly. Yes, there's a great story in the Desert Fathers where Anthony is asking his disciples about a particular passage in scripture, and he goes down the line. What does this one mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? All the disciples are giving their, you know, profound, lofty interpretation.
And he goes, you don't have it yet.
And he gets, you don't have it. No. And then he gets to, it's either Pullman or Pombo. It's one of the guys who became a great leader after Anthony. And he says, what does this passage mean? And the Pullman or Pombo, whichever one it is, says, I don't know. And Anthony goes, you have begun to interpret the scriptures.
Yes.
Right. So that's our disclaimer.
People are like, what? Like, but I've got a doctorate degree. What do you mean?
Yes. Yeah. But, well, that's the crazy. You have a master's degree, right? That's the crazy thing about today is it's like we want to pretend that we are experts and know everything. I was listening to a guy talk, it was a brief clip, and it was a really fascinating concept because he was saying, like, if I was to ask you, if every single belief that you have is true, you would probably say, oh, I don't know. You know, you'd be really hard pressed to say everything I believe is true. You would probably go, you know, there's probably things I believe that aren't true. Right? I mean, we all discover that, right?
But then if I was to... You have discovered that.
Yeah, but then if I was to ask you about each one of your beliefs, you would say, well, yeah, that's true. I believe that's true. Yeah, I believe that's true. Yeah, I believe that's true. So if I ask you about the generalness of all of your beliefs, you would admit probably some of them aren't true. But if I ask you about every one of your specific beliefs, you would say, well, no, that one's true. So where are you going to admit that one's not true? It was a really...
Boy, that's tough.
It was a really fascinating thought experiment, right? Because today in contemporary Christianity, we've got a lot of people claiming to be experts on the Bible. We have a lot of people claiming to be experts on theology. And then, but when we look at the history of it, we have a lot of people claiming, I don't actually know enough to even be an expert on this topic. And they became the experts that everybody went to. So,
who was it? One of the Desert Fathers, he's getting ready to go. He's going to pass on. God told him the date, and his disciples, you know, they're all getting ready. And he goes, you know, bring me the communion elements. You know, I want to repent. And they go, Father, you have no more need to repent. You're almost home. He goes, I have not yet begun to repent.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think it might have been Pombo.
Yeah, maybe that's why it was
one of those. Yeah. No, I know which one you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah, and or there's another one that was, it might have been Bishoy. There's anyway, it is. I have not even, but some of them would say things like, "I have not even begun to start to pray."
Yes, you know,
at the end of their life, that's a common refrain in the contemplative literature, especially in the Desert Fathers and the Desert Mothers. And we live in an age today where we're trying to convince everybody we know everything, but the earliest Christians were trying to convince everybody, well, actually we don't know, and we're trying to figure and work this out.
We're on the way. And why everybody, why Christianity was originally called the way, because it was considered a journey of becoming, a journey of change, a journey of we with unveiled faces behold his glory. Yeah. And you know, the church had terms for this.
Yeah. Let me clarify, it does. Let's clarify a little bit, because when we get down to some of the great arguments of the theological controversies of the early church, right? Cyril of Alexandria is not admitting to Nestorius that he doesn't know the hypostatic.
That's why there are councils. You know,
that's why there's councils. He's not admitting it, and neither is Nestorius. They're just arguing back and forth. So when you see the argument in that led to the Council of Chalcedon, not that they were dead by the time the Council of Chalcedon came, but they were the catalysts for that argument, right? These guys are two guys who we want to pretend Cyril of Alexandria, because he's a saint. We want to pretend that he's humble and he's great and everything, but man, the guy comes across as pretty pridefully arrogant.
Yes.
And so does Nestorius, right? They just took issue with each other's language. So we're not saying that every one of these figures in church history were like, I'm humble and I don't know, but there's some incredible refrains there that we find in church history where that's the demarcation of spiritual maturity, is not a claim to have all knowledge, versus today where, you know, people claim PhD and masters and all this makes us, we know all the stuff about scripture. So
anyway. I've written the book on it.
Yes.
And you know, everyone, it's quite interesting. Like with scholasticism that came out of the Catholic Church in like 1000s, 1100s, you know, you have this really big argument developing between the Catholic and the Orthodox. You can look this up online, between Barlaam and Palamas. I'd like to hear a Catholic's view of this, actually. But you know, Barlaam was saying God is unknowable. You can't know him. What you're calling the grace or presence of God is not God. It's an emanation from God, because you can't know God. So the Orthodox guys would say, well, no, I mean, you put a sword into fire. The sword doesn't become fire, but it takes on the characteristics of fire. It glows. Yeah. It gets warm. There's heat. And the presence of God, it is the presence of God, and it affects us, right? And you know, these guys we're talking about as charismatics, they fought the way for us. I think we forget that we're talking about very charismatic people, but they're saying this God is reality is inside of God. You know, yes. God is not outside of reality looking at it. I mean, you know, you'll see these icons of the Virgin Mary with Jesus in her womb. And then the universe inside Jesus.
Yeah.
And then you got to figure out what that means, right? It's like, goodness.
There's Augustine.
How does the brain know that?
Augustine had this concept, and I'll probably butcher it a little bit, but I'm pretty sure it was in his Confessions. And but I couldn't point to exactly where it is. But he talked about the nature of time.
Oh, boy.
And one of the things he said, and this is how I understood it. So anybody that's an Augustinian scholar, if our friend Matt Esquivel is
listening,
please don't call us. Yeah, you can. No, please correct me if I'm wrong. But do it later. Yeah, that's right. Because I think this is what I understood Augustine saying. Augustine is difficult to understand too. You know, it's looking through the keyhole thing, like Murray was saying. We haven't done the coyote howl, by the way.
There you go. We got to get it in. We got to break our streak. Yeah. It's like playing Wordle, and suddenly it's like you've only been just one day streak.
Watching. I watched the movie Hook with my kids last night.
Oh, brilliant!
Right, yeah. Brilliant movie. So now Robin Williams characterizes Peter Pan when he can finally crow with the rest of the lost kids. Right, the bangarang and cuckoo is like our howl. So That's what I've been doing with the kids now. Anyway, Augustine, time. He talks about how the what marks the passage of time is not time itself, but is conscious awareness of time passing. And so he says, a tree isn't aware that time has passed. To a tree, every moment is just present. There's no memory. Right. And even, you could even make the case for some of the higher forms of consciousness in the animal kingdom aren't really aware that time has passed. You're like, we have a chocolate lab. Our chocolate lab lives in the moment. Our chocolate lab may have learned certain lessons, but that's only because the body of the lab has been trained. And he's not thinking back over his vast resources of memory and thinking to the time that thing happened 5 years ago or 2 years ago. He's only 2 years old, right? He's not consciously aware of time passing. He's always present in the moment. He just knows what he needs, his appetite, right? Like, this is the peacock in the background, by the
no,
way,
it's
for anybody.
The sheep.
The sheep in the background.
I have a rescued lamb. He was rejected by his mom. And so before he joins the tribe, he has to be fixed, and he's got to get his vaccines, and he has to be bottle-fed. So
right.
He believes, he kind of seems to know the passage of time, because in 25 minutes, he's like, you better give me that bottle. That's what he's mad about.
Yeah. That's right. But again, he is aware of his need for food, right? He's presently aware that he needs something to eat and wants something to eat. So he's living in the present. So even as we go on the scale of consciousness, right?
Yeah. Animals, for sure.
Animals don't really live in the past. They live in the present. And human beings are the only, I mean, if you really like, show me another animal that has a depth of conscious awareness that humanity does, and an awareness of history and memory as humanity does. And outside of maybe an alien civilization that we don't know about
yet. Yeah, we don't. Yeah, right.
And so Augustine's point was that time is only perceived as passing because we're aware of previous moments.
Oh, very interesting.
Right? And so I'm pretty sure what he's extrapolating on is that time only, quote unquote, passes because creation resides within God, who is consciously aware.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, that hurts the brain.
Okay. So I'm pretty sure that's what Augustine's trying to work out in his Confessions, later in his Confessions. Now, an Augustinian scholar might be able to correct me on that, or maybe I'm making a couple conclusions about his observations on the nature of time. But time is not... I think his point is that time isn't an entity imposing its will on creation. It's the byproduct of God's conscious awareness of creation and the movements of creation, because creation exists within him.
Wow.
Okay. So that's something that'll get people thinking.
Throw out one too, because on podcasts you can do this.
Yeah. Well, time seems to exert itself upon us, and his point is, well, not really.
It's quite fascinating, because my brain, I'm trying to pull back which book I read this in now, which is horrible that I can't. But maybe it was Steve Stewart's new book on the mystical. Yes, it was Christ.
Go back. Go ahead. So for everybody, call back. Go. I think I knocked my microphone, so I hope everything's still working.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay. You can hear me. So
yeah, we're good.
Call back to the interviews we did with Steve Stewart a couple weeks ago. You can go back, look at those.
There's a quote in his book. Brilliant book. It's just coming out, everybody. You can look it up. Really worth your time. And very much in line with what we're talking about. But he quotes this one guy, one theologian, who says, he thinks, and he's got some, you know, we're talking about time and how time works, because God is outside of time. He believes, this guy, that when Jesus sees Elijah and Moses on the mountain, what's actually happening there, it's not that they're dead on the other side, that what's happening, because God is outside of time, and they're in the presence of God when they're on Mount Horeb, in their time periods, that the three of them are actually meeting in the moment with Jesus when they're all on the mountain, because they're all suddenly outside of time in the presence of God, even though they're on different locations in different time periods, suddenly they're together outside of time.
Right.
And it's all happening then.
That makes sense to me.
Does it?
For some reason it makes
you
sense.
You need counseling, man.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah,
well, the places and times are superimposed upon each other, right? They're with the timeless one, and they see a picture of his divinity in the uncreated light, right, on top of the mountain, and yeah. They're stunned. There's no photographic evidence back then. So how do they know this is Moses and Elijah?
How very interesting.
Right. Like they know it, but they have to know it supernaturally. They have to know it. So there's got to be something beyond just the physical happening in front of them.
Yeah. Right?
This overlapping of space, time, presence, and all that kind of stuff for them to go, Moses and Elijah are right there with us. You're like, well, how do you know? Like, you don't have a visual representation of him, and scripture doesn't even really explain it doesn't give a description of what Elijah looked like, not explicitly, or Moses, you know, that you would be able recreate him by a sketch artist or something, right? So how do they know? And
you know, because you're right, I always thought, well, maybe Jesus told them.
That's possible.
At the passage, they're figuring it out in the moment. It sure
seems
like it.
Yeah, sure, yeah. Looks like it. There's no record where it says Jesus said, hey guys, this is meet Moses. Moses, meet Peter, James, and John, right? Hey, Elijah, you know, meet Peter, James, and John, right? There's no formal introduction. Maybe that happened, but it seems like they kind of just recognize what's happening in the moment.
Yeah.
That's way more what the
author. And everybody, you know, it's again, you know, we got to interpret it too. You know, yeah. Elijah, they still set a table for.
Oh, we've got the sheep is attacking Murray now.
Sorry, he's like totally trying to headbutt me. He's moving out, but you can tell he's with a terrible twos right now.
Voices from the Desert is always an interesting journey for us.
I wish we had video because you guys would like this. The sheep is totally trying to headbutt me.
Yeah, that's right.
So Elijah, chief of the prophets, and then Moses, the law, both finding culmination in Christ.
Yeah, that's right.
There's this moment of what does it mean, right? You know, one of the things I thought the Lord said to me once, speaking of time, and this will all get us back to where we need to go. Anyway,
yeah.
But it's good for us to think about the bigness of God and being in awe. And this really does do that. Yeah. We do a ministry time in Samuel's Mount called Ancient Wells, where we ask the Lord to go back to the last place in your family line, the gifting functioned as it should, and bring it forward. Because once you realize God's outside of time, you can do that. So when the Lord was talking to me about that, he says, it just revealed this to me. So he goes, when John, do you believe the book of Revelation? This is kind of how the inner conversation went, is about the end times. Well, yes, I do. And so when John was in rapture and he's in heaven in the last days.
Yep.
I guess so. Okay, so then who are the 24 elders? I'm like, okay, 12 of them got to be the apostles. You know, I have 12 thrones judging the 12 thrones of Israel.
Right.
So John then is looking at Peter, James, and John. So he's seeing himself as dead for 3,000 years? I'm like, I guess so. And the Lord goes, what if the elder that walked up to John and says, do you understand these things? Was actually himself.
Yeah, that's right.
The self that's been dead for 2,000 years.
Yeah, it's possible.
It's like my brain was like, okay, time, alpha and the omega. It's all like,
yeah, that's right.
That hurt.
I'll just say this, and we'll get to our topic of
the day. We'll segue it back. We'll get back. We're not that far off the train track yet.
The word for truth in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew language is the word emet. I'm not exactly sure if that's how you say it, but the word is three letters, and it's comprised of the Aleph and the Tav, which are the first and the last letters of the Hebrew alphabet, right? So that's the first and last letter of the word for truth. And the third letter is the letter in the middle, and it's the middle letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So the word for truth is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, the middle letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And truth was seen as all encompassing, and Jesus being, so when he says, I'm the Alpha and the Omega, right? I'm the Aleph and the Tav. I'm the way, the truth, and the life.
Wow, that's cool.
I am all of reality, all of time, and everything summed up into one being is essentially what some of the mystics would have said Jesus was implying there. Anyway, it's really interesting stuff. So so we're still on this idea of the bridal paradigm in
and you know, maybe I'll just say this, I'll throw it out to everyone.
Yep.
The reason kind of why we're talking about this or even went this way is just the sense of awe of the nature
That's right.
of God.
That's right.
It doesn't just stir the mind, it stirs the heart. It That's stirs right. the inner man to want to know him more. And you know, we're wired to be in awe. We're made to be in awe. And see, the thing is, and I'll just throw out this too. And you know, reading some stuff of the Desert Fathers and this very interesting book called Orthodox Psychotherapy. but he says, you know, the brain really is a calculating machine, and it lives in the past and it lives in the future. Mainly that's what it does.
Yeah.
It thinks about, and if you, let's say you go to an airport and there's like 1,000 people there, go there and try not to categorize people. Try not to do it. Your brain will, but how you get into your heart, and this is bridal intimacy, is you start to think about things that cause you to be in awe, and you'll notice your brain actually stops for a second and goes, wow.
Right.
And that just happened. We just did.
Yeah. Like I'm thinking with that particular example, you see a giant airplane, right? On the tarmac, and you're looking out at the runway, and you forget that the people are around you. Right. And all you can see is this enormous machine. And it's like, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
Right. A feat of human engineering.
Right.
Or the eclipse, for that matter.
Which is a great example because again, it could draw you into awe, which brings you into your heart. Or you could go, what does this mean about the end times and going over the seven cities of Nineveh? I mean, which part, if you think about head and heart, which part is drawing you into bridal intimacy? Well, it's obviously the heart part, right?
Yeah.
And so what we're talking about today really is how to continually to cultivate that. Or how the Desert Fathers cultivated that.
Yes.
And right?
So
we're still on track. It's just
to get us even further on there, it's the eclipse, it's the plane, or it's Pelagia the harlot. And this is
read that story. Oh, it's perfect.
So there's this story in about the fourth, fifth century of a group of bishops that were having, I want to say they call it a conclave. There's a group of bishops holding a meeting. I can't remember what they called it exactly. There's this woman that comes down the road with her cavalcade of servants and suitors. And her name is actually lost to history. She was known as Pelagia because that was her adopted Christian name. But Pelagia was the woman. And she was
carried on a litter full of
incense
and silk.
Yes.
And
she is. She's an actress / dancer / famous woman for her beauty. You know, think of Marilyn Monroe and how Marilyn Monroe defined sex appeal in her time, or maybe someone like Angelina Jolie was the kind of the sex symbol, right? Or whatever, you know, any number of iconic women that were known for their beauty. Not that these women weren't also known for their talent and their skill and everything. I'm not saying that. I'm just, that was one of the things Pelagia was revered for, was her beauty. She was also an incredibly skilled actress and dancer. And all of the bishops are ashamed to see a woman in such array and turn their gaze away from her, except for Nonus, who's the most well-respected bishop there. He's captivated by her beauty. And it's like, that's not okay. Nonus, you're not supposed to gaze at this woman. You know, you're supposed to piously look down and not look her in the eyes. And it says literally as the story's rendered, it says, Nonus gazed after her very intently for a long space of time. And it says, after she had gone by, he turned around and still gazed after her. And Then he humbly turned towards the bishop sitting around him and said, "Were you not delighted by such great beauty?" Right? All the bishops turned their gaze down and were ashamed to look, right? "Were you not so delighted by such great beauty?" And then he poses this question to the group of bishops there. And he says, "What do you think, beloved brothers? How many hours does this woman spend in her chamber giving all her mind and attention to adorning herself for the play? In order to lack nothing in beauty and adornment of the body, she wants to please all those who see her, lest those who are her lovers today find her ugly and do not come back tomorrow." And so you can, maybe you can kind of guess where he's going with this, right?
Yes.
And then he says this, "Here we are, who have an almighty Father in heaven, offering us heavenly gifts and rewards, our immortal bridegroom who promises good things to his watchmen, things that cannot be valued, which eye has not seen, nor ear has heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man to know what God has prepared for those who love him. What else can I say? When we have such promises, when we're going to see the great and glorious face of our bridegroom, which has a beauty beyond compare, upon which the cherubim do not even dare to gaze, why do we not adorn ourselves and wash the dirt from our unhappy souls? Why do we let ourselves lie so neglected?"
Wow.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And I love the story of Nonus, right? And so as the story goes of Pelagius actually has an encounter with the Holy Spirit, and you know, encounter being our charismatic language. He has an encounter with the Holy Spirit. Bishop Nonus has a dream about her coming into the church so that he doesn't reject her when she comes.
And she does.
She comes just like the dream. Actually, as a dream, a dove comes in covered in soot, kind of dirty and everything, but he knows, but he just needs the dove, just needs to be washed off, and so he commits Pelagia to the care of some of the virgins and the widows, and then Pelagia actually flees the city and ends up she becomes known as Pelagius when she lives as a desert hermit in a cell where she doesn't entertain visitors outside of, you know, they have to stand outside of the door. And so she's a well-respected desert monk, and nobody knows that she's a woman until she dies. And Pelagia or Nonus is the only one who knows her secret. And it's huge funeral service for her. But when he sees her and thinks she spends so much time adorning herself for those who would be her lovers, that we have the ultimate lover and we can't even spend the same amount of time or effort on ourselves. We get so caught up in busyness. But we look at her and she's so much more dedicated to her lovers than we are to ours. And we have even more to compare it to, right? This is, he's not caught by her beauty. Yeah. He's actually not. He's caught by the beauty of God. And this is, again, we're talking bridal paradigm, right? He's caught up in contemplating the beauty of God. And that's because that's what he says, right? He says, "We have a Father in heaven offering us almighty gifts or heavenly gifts and rewards, who promises good things, and when we see the bridegroom, that when we see the glorious face of our bridegroom, which has beauty beyond compare," he's caught up in the beauty of God, and he's been so impacted by the tangible revelation of who God is that he's going, everything's got to change for us, and it's our and we're going to talk about this a bit later in the episode, but his whole point is prepare yourself for him.
And that's a big word that everybody, that we have to understand the difference between maybe how we are living Christianity today and how, well, the Eastern Church, I know they still do this, but you know, we're talking about working out your salvation in fear and trembling, as you know, Paul the Apostle would say.
Yes.
Not that I've already attained it, but I press forward to the goal. That there's a preparation for this bridal banquet that is happening. Yeah. And you know, and that's what he's alluding to here. As she prepared her physical body, so must we as Christians prepare our souls. And yeah, why?
Absolutely. Right.
And that's a question that we want to answer. That's how they're thinking, you know? And maybe I'll just read this quote from Saint Simeon then, because it does fit right here.
Yeah, go for it.
And so here's Saint Simeon, the new theologian. You know, he's about
12th century, right? 11th, 12th century, yeah, something in there.
You know, 1088, 10 something,
yeah,
right?
There we go. Yeah, somewhere in there, yeah.
Okay, so Just to hear this in regards to what Josh just shared about the bride and the bridegroom. And I'll read a little bit just again so we can get it into our heads, because we're going to go back to Eros Maniakos at some point here. And, you know, this goes somewhere and you're like, what? See last episode. The grace of the All Holy Spirit is given as a pledge to the souls betrothed to Christ. When a young girl has no pledge, so think engagement ring, she has no guarantee that her marriage to her fiancé will really take place. And it's just the same for the soul if it does not receive the pledge of his grace or does not possess him intuitively within her. So in other words, we're talking about a faith experience here, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and we charismatics would go, yeah, I get that. And that's why I think that, you know, we can resonate with this material, you know? It will then have no firm guarantee that it will be eternally united with its master and God, or that it will be mystically ineffably joined to him, or that it will joy in his inaccessible beauty. So, you know, for that, this is why I like the Passion Translation, and I'm just going to read Ephesians 1:17 here.
And for those, while you're doing that, for those biblical purists out there, we're not saying the Passion Translation is a perfect translation.
Yeah.
And we're not saying the New King James Version is a perfect translation. We compare and contrast what's said by different translators and authors and take what seems to make sense. So, yeah.
And this makes sense in the context of this passage. Yeah, as we went over it pretty hard last week, he has given to us, this is verse 16, he has given to us like an engagement ring is given to a bride as the first installment of what's coming. He is our hope, promise of a future inheritance, right? Which seals us until we have all of our redemption promises and experiences complete freedom. So again, the hope of our calling a little bit further on,
right?
Bridal, the wedding. His glorious inheritance of saints, the wedding. I mean, the context fits that well. But I just thought I would read that for you out there. Like, let's put it into modern English. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
If the parchment of a contract does not bear the signature of a reliable witnesses, the pledge is not a sure one. It's the same way. The illumination of grace is by no means assured until the commandments have been fulfilled and the virtues required. So in other words, we got to do our part here. We got to work on our holiness, work on our meekness, work on our purity. We've got to, you know, love the poor. There's something we got to do, and not just go, well, I'm saved by grace and that's it, right? There's this purification of the soul going on.
Right.
As witnesses are to contracts, so is the practice of the commandments and the virtues for this spiritual pledge. So you're not doing works here to escape the wrath of God.
Yeah.
Which is what we think. That's a bad way of thinking. He's a father, so let's not work at anything anymore. He goes, no, you're getting ready for a marriage banquet.
That's right.
You're purifying yourself for this beautiful moment. Think about, you know, that the parable of the guy that gets into the wedding banquet we talked about last week, and he doesn't have the wedding clothes on. He gets thrown out, you know, where, you know, these are the wedding clothes. It is in this way that all who are going to be saved, and that is I work up my salvation, I'm healing my soul, receive the full possession of the pledge. So I'll read one more little passage. It is just as if the contract is first of all written down through the practices of the commandments, then signed and sealed by the virtues. So you get started and then you grow in Christ. You become like him. It starts to be sealed. You're starting to see peace, joy, patience. You know, the fruit of the Spirit is starting to show up. Hey, you know, there's this bridal intimacy thing. We're on a journey. We're getting it. It's then that Christ, the bridegroom, gives the ring. Or the pledge of the Spirit to the soul, his bride. Boy, we're going to have to come back to that. Before the wedding, so here's the big deal. Before the wedding, all that the bride receives from her fiancé is a pledge. She waits until after the marriage to receive the agreed dowry and the gifts promised in it, so the inheritance. In the same way, the bride, who is the church of the faithful and the soul of each one of us, at first receives only the pledge of the Spirit from Christ, the bridegroom. She has to wait until she leaves this earth to receive the everlasting gifts, of the kingdom of heaven. Yet the pledge gives her the complete assurance that these agreements will not be deceptive. And so in other words, there's this journey of becoming, and it goes on and on a little bit here.
Yeah.
But this journey of how they're looking at Christianity is there's, you know, why are they praying? Why are they fasting? Why are they doing the seasons of the church, you know, why Lent, you know, right. I want to work on my inner man that it becomes pure and holy for the bridegroom.
Yeah. And that's right.
And, that's what contemplative prayer, that's the purpose of it. Right.
Oh, I'm going to say something I think is probably very controversial right now.
All right. You mean like you haven't done that already today?
Boy, actually, you made me think about it. So it's your fault.
I agree.
I
just like to do it so you get in trouble.
I had, in the words of Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes, I had an epiphany. anyway.
I love those guys.
Yes. So the reason we develop a theology that highlights in our redemptive model escaping the wrath of God, right? Because that's largely the system you and I grew up in.
Absolutely. And then, we rejected that, by going into, like, say, the third wave movement, which would be the Vineyard movement, which would be the charismatic, right? Like, which is good, except that maybe, there's some things that were not so good.
I'm hypothesizing something.
Ah.
The reason we developed that theology in terms of the Western church in general, the reason that theology has been developed, the redemptive model is escaping the wrath of God. Penal substitutionary atonement, right, is what we would kind of call it.
Oh boy, here we go.
Is because we have a system of thought. Oh man, I can tell this is going to. We have a system of thought developed by people who never encountered the love of God.
Well, there you go. Orphans.
Okay. Well, they're orphans, right? And so our system was escaping the wrath rather than encountering the love. And by encountering the love, we escape the wrath. We're not denying the fact that God has a bone to pick with humanity based on what humanity has done. You know, maybe that's bad language for it, but you understand what I'm saying. We're not denying that there's an element of God that is holy and reverential, and that there's anger, that any of those kind of personalized forms could take. Right? I mean, the scriptures talk about God being angry at certain things, and so we're not saying that's not there. But if you haven't encountered the love of God in a direct and experiential way, and that hasn't permeated your being, right? How else can John say perfect love has cast out all fear? There's no more fear in love because love includes the idea of punishment. He sets the stage for the culmination of the spiritual life being perfect love. And in fact, you could say, I had this thought today as I was reading the scriptures that Christ in his willingness, like when Peter says, I will die for you, right?
Yeah.
And Christ says, well, actually, you're going to deny me three times. What Peter was willing to die for wasn't actually for Christ. It was for himself. Peter was willing to die for himself because this is why I think that. Because when he stands in front of the rabble rousers that come to the Garden of Gethsemane to take Jesus, and he pulls his sword out and cuts someone's ear off, is because he's willing to die in a blaze of glory in that moment, right? But that's about him. That's not about Jesus.
Yeah.
Jesus proved that the content of his being was pure love right until the end, right? Yeah. And Peter wasn't willing to die for love. He was willing to die for himself, but he wasn't willing to die for love and set himself down. And so he didn't actually know the content of his heart until Christ convicted him in that moment. And so... pure love is seen right there. Why do we keep going back to models of wrath? I don't get it. Why do we keep going back to models of fear and anger? I don't get it.
Let's talk about this, because I think it fits this thing about the bridal paradigm. But
it does.
But part of it is, I think, and me and Father Mike had a lot of talks about this early on, and is that we tend to read Jesus, you know, in some ways through the lens of the Old Testament. And that's what the Pharisees were doing, right? That we were looking through at Jesus through a judicial paradigm, right, rather than a medical paradigm.
Right.
And so, you know, when the Pharisees say Jesus goes, you know, look at him, he's eating with sinners and tax collectors. You know, why are they so mad at him? Because he's breaking the law, which, everybody, Jesus sure liked to heal on the Sabbath. If you look how many times he does it, he's picking a fight. But Jesus goes, it's not that. It's not the sick that It's not the healthy that need a doctor. It's the sick. Jesus goes, your paradigm here is wrong. This is a sickness. You know, this mankind is, and you know, we are, right? So see, the thing is, how does that sickness manifest itself in regards to the holiness of God? Yeah. You know, and so we like to think, well, it means that God's a judge and he's going to kill us, instead of right. like, well, okay, think of it like this. And maybe we shared this a little bit with Father Mike, just briefly, but I'll do it again. So think about love and perfect love casting out fear. So let's say there's a couple and they really, really think about how communion, for some, communion is life. For some, communion is death.
Murray Cup, by the right? way, Murray Cup, we covered this. So anybody that wants more on this topic, we yeah. covered it in episodes with Father Mike
earlier Father Mike on the theosis. Podcast.
Yeah.
Really so worth listening those. To that yeah, right for sure. here after what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And so it, you know, it's interesting. So say, let's just think about love here. What does love do? How does Paul go from I'm equal to the most eminent apostles, you know, till I'm the chief of sinners? I mean, at the end of yeah. his life, you know, what's going on there? And still talking about I want to pursue Christ and know him. And so you think about these two people that, you mm-hmm. know, they love each other. They're cuddly. They're, you know, they're touchy feely, always want to be together. They always want to hold hands. And then one day one cheats on the other and they get back together. And now doesn't want to hold her hand, doesn't want to look at her in the eye, doesn't want to spend all that time together. Why? Because the same love that used to draw him now, because of the sin, burns his conscience and he just can't do it. Has she changed? Not at all. Has her love for him changed? Not at all. He, however, has spoiled his own soul, right? And now he sure. comes back into the presence of the very same love and it burns him, right? And you know, he needs to repent and get some healing and work on his issues. Absolutely. But is that her issue? No, that's his issue, right? And when we make it about, well, God's wrath, he's going to wipe me out. Well, you know, if you put if you're in a house, and boy, you should see my house right now. If you want to talk about dirt, I got a sheep living here. And let me tell you, I've learned something about sheep's anatomy. I was into eschatology. Now I'm just into
Scatology. Yeah.
Let me tell you. So, but even if I clean this thing up, let's say I swept it out and it's going to need that. But then I put in like a 10,000 watt light bulb. Oh my goodness. It's going to look horrible.
Right.
Right. But the issue is that it's not that it's clean when I sweep it. It's just that I don't have the illumination to see how dirty it actually yeah, is.
That's right.
Right. And as your soul gets purified and you get closer to the one you love, who is pure love, you get to see inside of you as the pure love, like lightning flashes in, what's really there. And it's scary. And you know, let me just quote Saint Simeon. And this is in regard to bridal intimacy that we just talked about. So it's interesting. It's on the same passage here. If I can find the same page 46, I think it was. Let's see here. Because he talks about the flashing of the divine light. If I can't find it in 30 seconds, everybody will just move on. Let's see here.
They can just imagine it.
Yeah. So he talks about once you get betrothed and you start to walk closer and closer to God, suddenly he starts to reveal some things about his nature supernaturally. And what does that do to you when you actually see God for who he is? Is it because it scares you? Is it because he hates you? Like, oh my goodness. Well, maybe it's because we're not in a place yet that if God revealed himself in his fullness, we can actually handle it.
Yeah.
You know? And you got to understand when Paul's talking about getting a thorn in the flesh, it's good to maybe keep this in mind, everyone. Because here's this guy turning the known world upside down. Today he'd have a podcast and the film crews would be following him around and he'd be building
Joe Rogan up there, church.
Yeah. He'd be sending teams out and multiplying himself and instead, he goes, well, God gave me this thorn in the flesh because of my pride. So, you know, after helping everyone else, I might not lose myself. Because he's like, I still have stuff in me that needs healing.
Yeah.
I'm doing all this outward miracles and stuff, but I could lose my own soul here because there's things inside of me from the fall. And he's like, for me, it manifests as pride. And I need to know my own weakness, that this what's going on isn't coming from me. How everybody loves me and thinks I'm so great. It's not coming from me. It's coming from Christ. I need this. Yeah. And to us in the Western church, because it's about the doing and the building rather than being and becoming. And the being and becoming is based on intimate, radical, bridal love.
That's right.
That we're going to a wedding banquet. So we want to prepare our hearts. We want to be ready, right? Instead of now I got all this work to do because God is my boss, or he's my judge and he's going to kill me. Well, right. Either of those paradigms are wrong. And the early church, the reason they're in the desert praying, they're working on their own souls. Two, they want an encounter with the bridegroom.
Right.
That's what they're doing. They're not thinking judicially here at all. Are they seeing their issues? Yeah, in regards to the divine light and this massive amount of love pouring upon them, right? Yeah. So just the category of how we're seeing the world is very, very different, you know?
Yeah.
So you have to read Simeon and the thoughts I just kind of laid out there in regards to that.
Yeah.
Because that's how they're thinking. This bridal intimacy is it's the driving force, this awe of the heart. And you know, charismatic, I'll just say this. You know, like, you know, how did I and Josh get here? How did I and Josh become like geeks of patristic literature?
Go back to listen to episodes 1 and 2.
Yeah. Like
yeah.
Like the same as you. Like, and I'll put money. You guys listen, I can make $100 here because I'm gonna be right. I bet ya. You had an encounter with God and it ruined you. You guys listening. And when it ruined you, you went back to church and you worked and you served and you followed the vision and you did all this stuff and it made you tired. And you're like, what happened to my first love? Where did it go? I got to have more because it ruined you. What did it ruin you for? Divine intimacy.
Yeah.
And then what were you given? Rules and law and here, go do this service.
Right.
And you did it thinking it'll bring me closer to Christ, but it didn't. And right. We all need to work and that's do right. stuff. I'm not saying that, but the paradigm doesn't work. Yeah. And you figured that's it right. out and you're like, there's got to be more. There is. And that's why the church talks about this. And that's how you ended up here. And that's how we ended up here.
Because
there is more. And it's this becoming bridal paradigm that the church always had. But when it gets hijacked, this bridal paradigm, to be a servant where you just work for the master. Right. The master does say enter into the joy of your master because it should bring you into deeper intimacy. So we're not saying, if you love, you want to give it away. It should be a byproduct. But you don't serve to earn love. Right. Because you're love, you serve. So we're not saying stop doing all that. But the idea of the working of the inner man, the encounter of God, the ravishment of God ruins you for the ordinary. Yeah. And it's ruined you. That's how these guys ended in the desert.
That's right.
And you know why? Because the church of its time had become corrupt and it was suddenly cool to be a Christian. And these people were like, this can't be all there is. And off they went into the desert. And the church right now, I think in the charismatic movement, is feeling that with all that, you know, all the corruption going on, all the stuff happening, people. You know, what's the word D, whatever they're, you know,
deconstructionism.
Yeah. They're like, I'm just so passionate. What do I do? That's why they did it right there. Right. But this is what we're talking about is what they discovered.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's just there's so much we could unpack in there. We've got
5-10 more episodes just on that.
I know.
But the paradigm is important as we talk about it, that you're realizing as you're listening. That if you're interpreting through your Western Christian lens and going, oh, I get it. That's not the right lens.
Yeah.
Right. This is the lens. But you're on the path. If these things are happening to you, This is kind of where you're going to end up. And we'll talk about, well, how do you do it? Well, then we're back to contemplative prayer and we'll get there.
So let's do this. Cause I've got, I think there's two things we could cover in the time that we have left. One, because that what you're saying, drawing us back to that place of the paradigm of love first, action flowing from there.
Yeah.
Love first, the contemplative mystical life flowing from there. Anyway, is you know, the bridal paradigm, to use the language we've been using, is what distinguishes, we'll use this term, Christian mysticism. I don't like the term mysticism, right?
And now we need to go into that. So let's keep going, ride that horse.
The term, for one, the term mysticism in its genesis was coined by Dionysius the Areopagite, so Dionysius is the figure in the book of Acts who Paul speaks to at the Areopagus and says, come teach us more. That's Dionysius. Legend has it, church history legend has it, that Dionysius became a great teacher in the early church. And there's a Dionysian school, which ended up being centralized in Alexandria. And so there was two main hubs of Antioch and Alexandria. Those were the two main theological hubs in the early church.
I didn't know Dionysius was connected.
Dionysius was
Alexandria.
Interesting. Yeah, he was one of the because he's in Greece, right? That's where Paul is. He's in Greece when he sees the altar to the unknown gods. And so anyway, so Dionysius is connected with Alexandria, if I remember getting all my stuff right. So, which it's possible that I'm not. Anyway, but Dionysius was one of the early guys that was accredited with starting one of those early schools of theology. So Dionysius ostensibly writes a book called The Mystical Theology.
Mm.
And that book was written most likely in the 5th century by a person writing under the pseudonym Dionysius of Alexandria.
Pseudo-Dionysius
of Alexandria. Although people have made the case that it actually is Dionysius, and when you look at it, you can make the case that it was Dionysius, you can make the case that it wasn't, whatever. So Dionysius wrote about divine mysticism, or mystical theology is the book. It's like 6 chapters, it's super short, you can read it if you want. But the word mysticism or mystical simply meant being concerned about the mystery of a thing.
Hmm.
So it was called mystagogy, right? Theology, mystagogy, the knowledge of the mystery of God. And the idea in mystical theology in Dionysius's work, and you can see this in two works that followed that, were The Divine Names and The Celestial Hierarchy, is that the path to knowledge to God is to acknowledge all the things that he is not. And once you start stripping all of the things that God is not, you start to clarify who he is. That's kind of the idea. And
apathetic,
so,
and cathartic.
They're called technical terms, apathetic and cathartic.
I always get it mixed up, though. I think that we're talking apathetic.
Apathetic is the removal of something. Apathetic, removing of pathos.
Got it. There you go. Right? So just throw those words out. If you type them in later on.
Yeah, that's right. So that's where the idea of mysticism comes from, is the mystery of God. Now, mysticism today has taken on the connotation of weird experiences, esoteric moments, divine visions, dreams, all these kind of things. But that's not really what the word mysticism means, and what we mean when we say Christian mysticism.
And what the church would like, everyone, just in regards, there's a really great little series called on mysticism called by Bishop Irene Steenberg. Where he'll go over this. It's brilliant. It's super good. I listen to it like once every 6 months. And Bishop Irene Steenberg on mysticism, and it'd be worth your time, because you want to get into their heads. This is a way to do it.
There's a series of books you can pick up also by Bernard McGinn, who has worked through the history of Christian mysticism too, given some good context for that as well. So there's lots of resources there. So when we say mysticism, we're talking about the study of the mystery of God and the experience of the mystery of God. That's what we mean. That the Spanish mystics used a word that would more aptly be translated as the contemplatives, those that contemplate the nature of God. And so that's probably a better term to use, right? So all of this to say that when we're talking about the bridal paradigm as the thrust of what Christian mysticism is all about, which is an encounter with something that impresses itself so divinely upon you that you can't help but be changed, which is the story of Nonus. I've caught a vision of the heavenly beauty. That heavenly beauty in Christian mysticism is localized in a person, which is Jesus. We see the divine figure completely represented as who God is. And the greatest expression of love is his willingness to die for all of humanity. So we have, when we talk about the person of God, the experience of God, we're not talking about a vague, ethereal, unformed or imageless thing, right? In that sense, we have the perfect picture of what God's like in Jesus. And so Christian mysticism always points us back to what God looks like in Jesus, because Jesus comes and explains God. The incarnation is what God is like. And there's obviously the mystery of God as being greater and bigger than anything we can possibly comprehend, but God is explained in the person of Jesus. And so the contemplative life is about being so impressed by the nature of God that anything we experience of him always points us back to what Jesus is like. So this is Christian mysticism, right? Yep. This is how we would define that. And then sure, strange experiences can happen, but they're not the thrust and the genesis of Christian mysticism. The thrust and the genesis is the bridal paradigm where we've been caught up in contemplating how beautiful he is. And we know how beautiful he is because we've seen what he's like in the person of Jesus, right? So this is, and so there's in the early 1900s, there was a lot of talk about syncretizing. What are the similarities in Christianity and Hinduism and Sikhism and Buddhism, and all these paths just lead to the same place. And so let's find all the ways that they're the same. Right. And this was syncretistic. The word is syncretism. It was the study of how all major religions lead to the same place. And it's realistically, it's completely stupid.
Yes.
Because once you start investigating the differences are so stark that you can use the same word. For instance, the Buddhist, I was just looking up some of the Buddhist prayers and reading them to Murray. The Buddhist would use the word peace, and the Christian would use the word peace. In their fill me with peace, right, would be a prayer that I could say and a Buddhist mantra that a Buddhist could chant. And we would mean wildly different things. We would mean wildly different things in the origin of the phrase. We would mean wildly different things in the practice of the phrase. And we would mean wildly different things in the outworking of the phrase. And so what we want to say is this whole concept of the bridal paradigm is really what distinguishes Christian spirituality, Christian mysticism from Eastern spirituality and Eastern mysticism. This is really the thing that differentiates it.
Yes.
And I'm going to read a quote for you. And this is pointing back to the practice in the Hindu religion, which I think they're up to about 3 million gods in the Hindu religion now. It might even be more than that. And this is from a Orthodox archbishop named contemporary guy. He's still writing, Archbishop Chrysostom. And he said this in his book, Themes in Patristic Psychology. He does not become, meaning he being the individual human, man or woman, he does not become in the primitive image of the ancient Upanishads. The Upanishads is one of the religious works of the Hindus. He does not become in the primitive image of the ancient Upanishads like a river flowing towards the universal sea of divinity, there to be swallowed up in the totality of being and personhood itself. Instead, he remains a distinct drop within that sea, never becoming what the sea is in its whole, but remaining an identifiable unique entity, sharing in the energies of the infinite, ineffable essence of the Godhead. Okay, so the difference between, and this is where we need to, I feel like we need to clarify this, the difference between Eastern mysticism and Christian mysticism, you know, to use those terms,
yeah,
is that in Eastern mysticism, the goal is the emptying of the self and the becoming of divine nothing, encountering the divine nothing and losing yourself, because yourself is all the things that you don't want to be anymore. And in Christian mysticism, the goal in emptying yourself is to encounter something that is very real, tangible, and definable. And it's indefinable, but definable. It's indefinable, but that thing defined itself in the person of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a big difference. So when you look at some of the, say, the Hindu prayers versus the Christian prayers, we have a very definitive beginning point and an ending point in the Christian. We're looking towards the person of God. We're looking at being filled with the person of God. And so my path is not emptiness for emptiness' sake, which is what you find in Buddhist practices. If I am emptied, then I will find peace because I will no longer have the chaos because I've been emptied, right? And I can pull up a prayer for you. In the Buddhist Litany for Peace, as we're together praying for peace, let us be truly with each other. Let us pay attention to our breathing. Let us be relaxed in our bodies and our minds. Let us be at peace with our bodies and minds. Let us return to ourselves and become wholly ourselves. Let us maintain a half smile on our faces. Hmm. Let us be aware of the source of our being, common to us all and to all living things. So the whole point, I think I knocked the microphone again. Oh, can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm good.
The whole point, To be back in a place, to be in a place of peace, is to be present with yourself, empty of all of your chaos. In Christianity, to be at a place of peace is to be present with yourself, empty with your chaos, empty of your chaos. Yes, we could say that, but the emptiness of chaos doesn't generate peace in the Christian mind. The emptiness of chaos generates space for God to come in his peace and grant peace to the individual. And so peace is a tangible thing you experience. It's actually an energy of God that you come into and participate with, and you become peaceful because you're participating in an energy that already exists outside of you.
So the word grace, everybody, in Greek is the word energia, where we get the word energy from, right? So yeah, the divine energy of God, grace.
Yes.
And so yeah, be still and what? Just be still? No, be still and know that I am
be
God.
Still and know. Yes. So there's a vast chasm between the two.
Oh yeah.
And so for instance, another distinction would be in the Baha'i faith, which is the Baha'i faith. Having problems with my mic here. The Baha'i faith, another place where Eastern mysticism would draw. And what we're really talking about is New Age contemplative practices and things like that, because people get really wound up about talking about Christian mysticism and contemplative prayer. So look at the Baha'i faith. The Baha'i faith is going to say, look, we have a divine word, and Christians, you have a divine word. But the divine word in the Baha'i faith is a ethereal substance. The divine word in the Christian faith is a logos.
It's a person.
It's a personal thought that has rational comprehension, that has expression, that's absolutely definitive and known. And this is what the early Christians were arguing about with the Greek philosophers when you get into Origen and Tertullian, is about the nature of the divine word. The divine word is not a ethereal expression. The divine word is a personal expression with personhood that's definitive, not kind of an absolute infinity of personhood, but an absolutely defined person in the person of Jesus. And so all of this just goes to show you that when we start investigating the differences, and I'm not trying to criticize anybody that wants to practice Hinduism or anything like that. Is I'm just saying, don't call them the same thing, and don't get confused when we talk about them and say, well, they're talking about contemplative prayer. They must be talking, that's just New Age mysticism. No, actually, it's not. It's very different. Maybe how other people talk about it, it's the same. But how we're talking about it, we're making a very big distinction between the two. Because the way we see it, there is a massive distinction, gulf between the two, a chasm that can't be crossed.
And it's because of a personal love relationship. So let me read a little bit out of this just to You'll like this. So everybody, this is a good, if you're interested in this, there's a great book called The Mountain of Silence by Kyriakos C. Mercedes. And so he was...
It's barely by him, though. It's really just Maximus talking. Father Maximus talking, yeah.
But if you want to kind of jump into a modern... I mean, you're not going to necessarily agree with everything in here, but it'll give you the framework. So I'm just going to read you a couple pages, but a little bit of this and that in regards to this, just to sum this up. How does this fit with divine eros, this divine love? So I'll read you a little bit just to modernize all this. The spiritual methodology developed by the saints, Father Maximus explains, aims at offering us the possibility of the direct vision of God. So what did the Desert Father said? A theologian is one who prays, and one who prays is a theologian. But yes, they mean what they don't mean somebody who reads books and has a degree. They mean a theologian is one who sees God, right? Yeah. That's
prays truly. It says a theologian is one who prays truly, and one who prays truly is a theologian.
Because they have the spiritual methodology developed by the saints, aims at offering the possibility of the direct vision of God. When that happens, as I've said many times, it is no longer a matter of belief in the existence of God, but a direct recognition of the eternal and unbroken relationship that exists between gods and humanity. And of course, the essence of that relationship, he says, is love, which first emanates from God to humans and then from humans to God. It may sound scandalous to some people, but the full flowering of that relationship is the attainment of a deeply erotic relationship with God that lies far beyond the most intense and the most passionate erotic rapture between human beings. That state of ecstasy is what Saint Maximus, the confessor, called the Eros Maniakos. Do you know what I'm speaking of? Father Maximus asked and turned towards me with a quizzical look on my face. I'm afraid I don't, I said softly. Having been blessed only with the experience of human Eros, I could not possibly fathom what Eros Maniakos might feel like. I could only imagine such a state intellectually. I could accept, for example, that all erotic relationships at all levels of intensity form the sublime and the absolute love of God. It is like the sun emanating its rays. Human Eros is the experience of the rays. Eros Maniakos must be the entrance into the sun itself. Good example. And so, I mean, this is kind of what they're talking about here, that we're going for a relationship with a person that's very deep, intimate. And so I'm going to read you one more little piece here.
And we'll wrap up with that little piece there.
Once the gifts of the grace are bestowed upon a person through faith, then theosis is the next and final destination of the soul's journey. So this is, again, it's like we're peering through a keyhole, talking about things we've maybe glimpsed that keep us hungry, keep us going. But boy, oh God have mercy for me even to talk about it. This stage is beyond all stages and defies all human understanding. According to the tradition of the holy elders and the Christianity in general, the individual soul does not lose its uniqueness upon its return to God. So again, the very big difference between Buddhism and Hinduism and Christianity. It does not merge with God in such a way that its autonomy is compromised or destroyed. The prodigal son does not lose his identity upon his return to the palace. On the contrary, he carries along with him into his new deified state the accumulated experience of his worldly sojourn. This particular point may be one of the key differences between spirituality of the Christian elders and some Buddhist beliefs concerning the final destination of the human soul. From the perspective of Christian elders, what is annihilated through catharsis, fasting and prayer, is not the inner self-awareness, the I-ness, but there was some total of egotistical passions, lust, pride, anger, gluttony, add your list, that obstruct our vision of God. These things obstruct our vision. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Saint Seraphim of Seraph may be in a state of oneness with God, but he still remains autonomous within that oneness as a self-aware soul. As Saint Seraphim serving God's plan. So here's a guy that would see the divine light, Seraphim. In saying that, one needs to be reminded that the best of all wisdom traditions were becoming one with Christ. So, in spite of these inherent limitations in understanding, theosis and spiritual great saints, contemporary theologians, try to convey to us the most feeble glimpse of this ultimate mystery of human destiny. The divinization of the individual is the supreme gift of grace in the Holy Spirit, wrote a contemporary Greek theologian. These theosized human beings undergo changes, not only in mind and soul, but also in body. And they were talking about these guys that brace, that individuals forget ordinary bodily needs as food and sleep, since they don't have the physical urges. You know, they're in this connection. We're talking about way beyond our understanding here. Such persons no longer are even confined to the physical laws of ordinary humans. Their souls have tasted the depths of divine eros and the sweetness of mental gifts, and therefore it cannot rest on what it has so far achieved, proceeds to further heavenly realms. Wow. And one last thought. Finally, the teaching of the holy elders about theosis has its social dimension. Theosis must not be seen within the context of personal egocentric joy. It is often stressed by holy elders that the theosized individual, even though he's attained perfection with God, they're serving and now they're doing stuff and they're giving it away and it flows out of them and they pray for the world and because they can't keep the love in them. I just quoted that part.
That's right.
But the point is that when you're what you're experiencing is this hunger for more of God. I remember when Gregory Palamas, who was fighting with Barlaam that God could be known, and Barlaam was like, "No, you can't know God on this earth." And he's saying, "No, that this grace, this presence of God, is God." On his deathbed, John Chrysostom appeared to him in a dream. You know, so he's 300s and Palamas is 1450s, 30s probably. And he says to him, "To the heights, to the heights," meaning, "Son, you haven't experienced yet."
Yeah, that's
right.
And
I'm pretty sure C.S. Lewis gets his thought out of the Chronicles of Narnia as one who loved the Desert Fathers. Further in and higher up, as their children that's are right. running through Narnia, further in and higher up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking about the divine goal, but the divine goal is what? It's a person.
That's right.
Jesus Christ. It's a relationship. Right. Jesus Christ. I want to be a pure, spotless bride. Why? Because of Jesus Christ. Not that's that right. I've already attained it, but I press on to the higher goal, as Paul says, to know him.
Him.
Jesus Christ.
Not it. And not nothingness.
That's
him.
Why this whole thought, talk about, you know, of this divine marriage and the ring, you know, setting, as St. Simeon said earlier, it's preparing us for something greater. And,
that's right.
And to realize that Christianity goes, yeah, there is something greater. How do you do it? Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. But it's not like, okay, now I better live under the law. That's not what they're talking about.
Right.
They're talking about being zealous for a person.
That's right.
It's not like we need a diet plan to lose weight. Okay, now I'm going to start my new diet plan because it doesn't work that way. It's this journey of becoming. But it has to be based on a loving personal relationship. And that's the point of contemplative prayer, everybody. Right there.
Yeah.
That's the point of fasting. Is for the body not to rule your soul. It's for your spirit in hunger for God to rule your soul. Which is going to do it? Your desire on the way home to stop at McDonald's or your hunger for God to pursue him? Where are we living out of? And contemplative prayer in its essence is to pursue Christ.
That's right.
Anyway, well, there you go.
And that you know, as far as how you do it, you know, Murray just kind of alluded to, it's about the journey. Well, one of the things that we're going to pick up on next week is the schema of what it looks like to style your life in a way that pursues that.
Yeah, because they're doing, you know, they're doing stuff. You know,
there are practices. There are practices, right?
But, Father Mike always likes to say, because you got to partner with grace. So, and this is another place the modern church kind of falls down. Well, once I'm saved, that's it. You know.
Right.
But it's kind of, Father Mike would say, you have to partner with grace. It's like if the sun is shining outside, you want to get a suntan, you got to go outside, you know? So
the question of how we do that,
how do you do
is our next episode.
Yeah, hopefully, probably yeah. not one.
Hopefully,
either.
Well, yeah, hopefully multiples. So, with that said, Murray, let's draw this one to a close. It's been wonderful spending time with you, and I hope that we left all of you listeners with a lot of food for thought.
Yeah,
and
everybody, if you don't get all that, don't worry about it.
And listen to it again and yeah. again and again, and you still won't get it because we don't get it. That yeah. was our. That was our opening statement, our asterisk at the beginning is we don't really know what we're talking about because you can't know what you're talking about.
So again, like when you don't get it, let's just say one last thought on that. That's brilliant, but are you hungry for it?
Yeah, there you go.
Because if you're hungry for it, you're living out of your inner man. But if you need to know it in your head right away, I think just we'll close with Ephesians 3. You know, Paul's in prison. People are freaking out. And he says, I pray God would strengthen you in the inner man, the part that of you that's hungry right now, so that you would know how high and wide, so Christ may live in your heart by faith. Well, so we'll talk about that. To know how high and wide and long and deep is the love of Christ that surpasses gnosis, head knowledge, that you may be filled to all the fullness of God. Human understanding does not necessarily get you full to the fullness of God. Walking in love and hungry gets you to the fullness of the fullness of God. And so if that's what you're experiencing right now, enjoy it. Don't go, I don't understand it. That's okay.
Yeah, that's right.
It'll come in time.
That's right.
That's the Lord's job.
Yeah.
But realize, boy, there's a part of me that wants to pursue. Stoke that fire.
That's right. There you go.
And then we'll talk about how to do that next week.
Yeah, we'll talk about that next week. Yeah. Well, everybody, thanks for coming along and tuning in. And Murray, thanks for spending time. It's been awesome. And until next week, we will see you later.
Bless you, everybody. Thanks for letting us play with your brains. Bye.
Yes. Bye.